The 18th of July this year marked 10 years since the body of Dr. David Kelly was found in a wood near his Oxfordshire home. A public inquiry headed by Lord Hutton concluded that Britain's leading germ warfare expert committed suicide. Those who questioned the procedure or the verdict are scorned as conspiracy theorists. 4 years later, in response to a Freedom of Information Act request, the police revealed that there were no fingerprints whatsoever on Kelly's knife, on the tablet packets in his coat pocket, or on the water bottle found nearby. My next guest started out as a conspiracy theorist, believing Kelly had been murdered. However, as he closed in on the subject, he came to realise the truth was a lot more complicated. He joins me in studio today to discuss his latest book, Dark Actors, The Life and Death of David Kelly. Robert Lewis, good morning to you.
Good morning, Miles.
You're from the same part of Wales as David Kelly, but you had no particular knowledge or specialised knowledge of Middle Eastern politics or weapons of mass destruction. So why did you want to take on this story?
Well, I approached it as I think a lot of people in Britain did. I didn't know why the war was happening. I didn't believe in the arguments for the war. The war happened anyway after the biggest protests in human history. And we were waiting for an explanation we could understand. We were waiting for the lie to be exposed. And all of a sudden, out of the shadows came a whistleblower who seemed to speak the truth. And for a moment, I think, Britain thought the truth was going to break through and the lie would be exposed. And we would understand why we went to war, which is no small thing. We would understand why we really went to war. And instead, none of that happened. David Kelly died. The Hutton inquiry, in fact, four other inquiries have all not delivered the truth on the Iraq war. And Britain has never really been able to accept the silence that came after Kelly.
But you were convinced that he had been murdered.
Yes, I was
before
convinced.
Before you started this process.
I was convinced. I think over half the country was probably convinced. It looks like a classic assassination. It looks like something is rotten in the state of Denmark. I mean, it has all the ingredients for that. And when I started writing this book, I thought I would be closing in on a murder, and I would be exposing a crime. And yes, I realised the truth was more complicated.
And you began your search in South Wales. You went to the town where he was born. You spoke to his family. What did you hope to gain from all of that?
Well, my plan was to follow Kelly as a biographer, because Kelly's end eclipsed his life. And if you want to understand his end, you have to understand his life. You have to understand the man himself and the world in which he lived, which was a strange, sort of mysterious, murky world of intelligence. And I wanted to get a sense for who he was as a man. And as a man, he was almost invisible, which is the sort of person you tend to be if you work in intelligence. So I went to Pontypridd. He was born in Pontypridd, which is a town in the valleys near where my father was born. And I spoke to he has some distant family there. His immediate family, of course, have never spoken to anybody ever since the day he died. But his extended family there were able to tell me a bit about him. And as I spoke to them, and as I spoke to the friends and colleagues he made throughout his adult life, I got a sense of a person who was totally different to the person that burst onto our television screens in 2003.
And how was he different? In what way did the man that appeared on television and in the media, in what way was he different to the one that you found when you began your research?
Well, of course, we only saw him fleetingly in 2003 when he was hauled before a parliamentary committee. And those who can remember it will remember a blinking, bespectacled, bearded boffin. He seemed hesitant and shy. He seemed under great pressure. He seemed tentative. That was Kelly playing the grey man. Kelly was a hard-edged, cautious, deliberate, expert man who had worked for months on end inside the Soviet Union, inside Russia, inside Iraq, often in very dangerous environments where he could trust no one. And he was used to a great deal of pressure, and he was used to a great deal of self-containment. And talking to a few MPs from the Shires did not bother him over much. I mean, he wasn't greatly troubled by the attentions of Parliament or the press. He'd been through a lot more. They weren't key. They weren't first and foremost amongst the pressures that were acting on him. when he decided he would end his life.
Okay, we'll talk about those pressures as we go along. But how did his wife describe his mood on the morning before he left his house on that walk from which he never returned?
Well, his wife was quite succinct. She told Lord Hutton that he was tired, subdued, and maybe a bit downbeat, but certainly not depressed, and had never seemed depressed in any of this. And then in the second sentence, she added, "I just thought he had a broken heart." But she never said why, she never expanded on why, and Lord Hutton never asked her, and she's never told anybody anything more.
He was accused of leaking to a journalist that the British government's case for going to war with Iraq had been deliberately exaggerated, had to use the phrase that became current at the time, had been sexed up. Much of this information, however, could have been deduced, could have been taken from the public domain. So why was his conversation with the journalist so important and so sensitive?
Well, indeed, much of it could have been taken from the public domain, and there were people outside the intelligence community who'd been saying Iraq didn't have WMD for a long time. But where he came to the attention of Westminster was that he told a BBC journalist that the government knew Iraq didn't have WMD. And the point of his briefing was effectively to say that the spies weren't wrong. The spies knew there weren't WMD, and it was the government, it was the politicians who had tasked the spies, really, to produce this disingenuous dossier. And that, of course, was what got him into hot water, because he found himself on his own front line then. He found himself in a battle between the media and Downing Street.
Was he leaking on his own behalf? Was he leaking on behalf of somebody else who could then deny that he was leaking on their behalf?
Well, I spoke to Brian Jones, who was formerly his boss in the Defence Intelligence Staff, which is that part of the British intelligence community that is analytical. They do desk work. They don't tend to go out into the field. And we don't know for sure, but Brian is a figure of some authority. And as far as Brian Jones was concerned, David Kelly was speaking to journalists after the invasion, specifically so MI6 didn't get the blame for WMD claims being disproven, and to make sure that the blame fell elsewhere, and it could only fall at Downing Street. So his leaks were a preemptive tactic by MI6 to make sure Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell would get the blame and not the Secret Intelligence Service.
Because the MOD, they warned him, or they said they were going to warn him. That was one of the potential penalties, if you like. But they did ultimately stand by their man.
Well, they did to an extent, but the problem with Kelly is that he had many masters, and some of them remain obscured. Officially, he was working for the Ministry of Defence, but he told people I'd spoken to that he had more than one boss, and his other boss included MI6, which would have meant working for the Foreign Office, and that was kept entirely out of Hutton. But but numerous people knew about it or had very strong and authoritative suspicions. And the Foreign Office, of course, is a different boss entirely to the MOD. And he wasn't working for either. Officially, he was working for a lab in Wiltshire, which was the Defence Science and Technology Laboratory. That doesn't include his routine contacts with the Central Intelligence Agency, the US State Department, or Mossad. So he was deeply, deeply plugged in to the world of intelligence. And the MOD have really been the only public face of many departments and organisations that he was working for.
He was also plugged into international journalism, because there was an email in his inbox from a New York Times journalist, Judith Miller. Now, she also was, in a sense, collateral damage over a different episode in all of this. But that email gives you the title of your book, Dark Actors.
That's right. Judith Miller is an intriguing character, in that, she later went to prison herself for a story that we probably don't have time to go into here. But, she's an interesting character, to say the least. She worked with Kelly. She talked to him frequently about very sensitive information. Miller's contacts in America are a very interesting consideration. But, yes, She told David after he returned from his committee hearing that his final committee hearing that was to decide his fate. She told him that she'd heard from his fan club that things had went well for him, and she hoped everything would be okay. And Kelly, by this point, has begun to appreciate that there are those around him who do not hold his interests at heart, and it seems that Miller is one of these. And Kelly's email to her complained that he was besieged, beset by many dark actors playing games. He no longer knew who was who or what their what his friends' agendas were. And as I say, that's because he was very much in the thick of it. He was in the centre of an intelligence community, and all of a sudden he found very, very abruptly that his masters had become his enemies.
There were several details about his death, I've mentioned some of them already, that warranted further investigation. They include a statement of his colleague, Mai Pedersen, to the absence of fingerprints and more. Tell us about some of these incongruities.
Well, the incongruities, there are lots of incongruities. And the problem is that the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, and MI5 leave secrets. They leave incongruities wherever they go. And when Kelly's body was found, nobody really knew whether it was a suicide or an assassination. Nobody knew. And first on the scene were people from SIS and MI5. And in all likelihood, they went through his pockets and they went through his belongings before he was passed on to the civilian police, which is why they were, which is probably the most plausible explanation as to why there are no fingerprints on the knife, because any fingerprints on the knife would have revealed fingerprints of serving intelligence officers, which could not be allowed in civilian police departments. They have to be, they have to be kept out of the limelight in that way. And this sort of thing happens whenever there's a suspicious death amongst the intelligence community. Things are kept back from the coroner. In this case, the whole death was kept back from the coroner. But those incongruities are the stamp of the presence of the intelligence community. But that doesn't mean. It doesn't mean that they're responsible for his murder.
The theories regarding why he would have ended his life vary from an alleged love affair with that colleague, Mai Pedersen, to the struggle between the government and the BBC. What is your opinion now about his motivations?
Well, it was a journey for me. I'm aware of the story, and I know the journalist who has reported it. I'm aware of the story that he was about to leave his wife to go on some, because of some love affair with Mai Pedersen. I'm aware of that story. That story came out after the Hutton inquiry. That story doesn't check out. I'm aware of at least one of the sources who is putting that story out. It's a source that refuses to go on the record, has privately withdrawn disproven claims in the past. And if the claims about Mai Pedersen could be proven, if they were thought relevant, they should have been brought up at Hutton. And I think it's very strange that this story is surfacing after Hutton, that David Kelly killed himself because of a private love affair. I mean, to those who are uninitiated, it seems like a plausible reason, but I've investigated it and none of the circumstantial details check out, and I think the fact this story exists is itself indicative of something.
But you do believe he killed himself?
Yes, I do believe he killed himself, and I found out from the Thames Valley police psychologist who cooperated, who worked very closely with his surviving family, that his security clearance was revoked before his suicide. David Kelly had top secret security clearance since 1991, and it was revoked abruptly, I believe, on the last day of his death. On the morning of his final day, he was still expecting to go out to Iraq, which would have been impossible had his security clearance been revoked. And having your security clearance revoked isn't something that happens in isolation. You don't hold top-level security clearance for 12 years and then lose it like it's an executive parking space. That doesn't happen like that. What happens is you get investigated, and you get investigated on a personal level and very, very intensely, because if you lose it overnight, then you're a security risk, and the question is, how long have you been a security risk?
Right. We unfortunately have to leave it there. It is an intriguing story. It still intrigues, even as you said, 10 years after his death. The book is called Dark Actors, The Life and Death of Dr. David Kelly by Robert Lewis. It's published by Simon & Schuster UK. It's priced at £18.99. That's £18, 99 pence in hardback. So around about 25, 26 euro. Robert Lewis, thank you very much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you, Mills.